I'm Abigail Galvan. Welcome to EWTN Pro-Life Weekly.
He was able to be articulate and compassionate, but also never cowered, never shied away from the truth.
Remembering Charlie Kirk, the conservative activist assassinated while speaking on a university campus, and his pro-life legacy.
This revenue comes from a mixture of tax dollars, often in the form of grant funding.
Planned Parenthood is raking in close to $500 million in pro-life states. We break down the numbers.
Instead of promoting these false narratives that are designed to turn people against pro-life laws, we need to talk about what the real causes of maternal mortality are.
Countering false perceptions about maternal mortality and pro-life laws. How better education on these laws could save lives.
The leaders of the nation have been shaken, as have university students and college students and young people all across the country. It's as if the ground was shifted beneath us.
U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson was one of several senior Republican figures at the Kennedy Center in Washington on Sunday evening, paying tribute to conservative activist and pro-life advocate Charlie Kirk. 31-year-old Kirk was assassinated last Wednesday while speaking at a campus event at Utah Valley University. The father of two was the founder of the conservative youth organization Turning Point USA. Law enforcement arrested 22-year-old Tyler Robinson as the suspect who they say fatally shot Kirk. In the wake of the deadly shooting, prayer vigils and memorials have been held across the country, from major halls like the Kennedy Center and football stadiums holding moments of silence to smaller gatherings in cities around the nation, all mourning his senseless death. This video from September 13th in Midtown Manhattan shows a large crowd holding American flags and singing the national anthem in tribute to Charlie Kirk. Kirk was unwavering in his strong pro-life stance. He actively debated students on college campuses in the United States from coast to coast. Take a look at some of the arguments he made in defending the life of the preborn.
When you see abortion, you will have your life will be changed. That we allow the massacre of 1.5 million babies a year under the guise of woman reproductive health.
We have overseen the slaughter of our fellow citizens over the last couple decades. This is a genocide, dare I say, a holocaust of our citizens that has occurred since Roe versus Wade.
Some would say, well, Roe versus Wade is repealed, the fight is over. Wrong. That is the beginning of the fight, everybody. Now we have to go and we have to win referendums in states. We have to win hearts and minds. In America, you are the center of the planet for pro-life activism around the world. Right here. This is the center of the entire planet. You could be pro-choice of whether or not you're going to have sex. I actually, as a pro-lifer, have a heart for women that get abortions most of the time, because I think they've been lied to by an abortion industry, be told that it's just a clump of cells and not a human being. Human rights do not stop just because of the location of an individual or the size of an individual or how developed an individual is.
Kirk is one of many activists that are invited onto college campuses to hold debates. His death has sparked outrage from millions of Americans and supporters of his work. It also has, unfortunately, prompted celebration from some of those who disagreed with him. Kristen Hawkins, president of Students for Life of America, is a pro-life activist who visits universities across the United States. She was actually on a university campus the day of Kirk's assassination. Hawkins spoke with EWTN News In-Depth's Catherine Hadro about the concerning response that some students gave after she told them Kirk was shot and the safety measures she is taking.
That's why when I announced to them that my friend had been shot and we were trying to find updates on Charlie's condition. We were getting reports from the hospital, and they laughed because this is a culture of death. This is what a culture of death breeds. When you say it's okay to kill innocent babies and that there should be no recourse to kill innocent, helpless babies who are the most innocent among us, this is what it leads to. And this is why we say it's a culture of death that must be defeated. And this is why we can't abandon the campuses right now. There's been a lot of talk. I mean, I'm sitting at home with newspaper on my windows right now. I've got an armed guard in my driveway. There's changes that are going to happen for my family's safety. There's going to be changes that have to happen to be safe.
The reality is the death threats against political activists is nothing new. Neither are attacks against pro-life activists and pro-life organizations like pregnancy resource centers. After the overturning of Roe v. Wade, a New York pregnancy center was firebombed. And shortly after, it was vandalized with pro-abortion graffiti. More recently, a pro-life journalist from Live Action was attacked by a woman she was interviewing on the street. These actions are only emboldened by political leaders who weaponize laws to attack pro-life organizations. Massachusetts launched a $1 million taxpayer-funded campaign telling women to avoid crisis pregnancy centers. And New York Attorney General Letitia James sued pregnancy centers for promoting the abortion reversal pill. David B. Wright, founder of 40 Days for Life and executive director of the Life Leadership Conference, is no stranger to being on the receiving end of hate while advocating for life. I connected with him earlier to talk about Charlie Kirk and the, at times, dangerous work of standing up for life. David, it has been a heavy time in America. Charlie's death has touched thousands and reveals an ever more fragmented and divided nation. You've been in the same circles as Charlie. What did you admire about him?
Oh, my gosh. There were so many things to admire about Charlie and what God used him for in his 31 years. You know, the first thing that comes to mind when I think about him is I always admired how he built Turning Point USA, starting at 18 years old and turning it into a grassroots movement that really galvanized an entire generation on campuses. And having myself built a grassroots movement from scratch, 40 Days for Life, and seeing that spread across the United States and beyond, I always knew how tough that work is, but how important it is to activate people to constructively respond to the challenges of our day. The other thing I really admired about Charlie, of many different things, was his ability and his willingness to go and engage people who disagreed with him. And he was able to be articulate and compassionate, but also never cowered, never shied away from the truth, was always willing to go and engage. And I think that's something all of us can learn from and be inspired by. His legacy truly lives on.
Amen. And it's often a very tough line to walk. Now, Charlie's arguments for life were strong. They were founded in science, but he also backed his scientific arguments with morality and his Christian faith. As the founder of 40 Days for Life, prayer was at the core of your work. Can you talk about the need for faith in this movement?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for the large majority of us, we are involved in the pro-life movement because we recognize that human life was knit together in a mother's womb by God in his image and likeness. And one of the amazing things we saw over Charlie's life is how faith became more and more central to his life, and he began to articulate faith in all of his arguments as he progressed, including the case for life. So yes, science is on our side. Yes, we can make the case for life by using real lived experience and medical authority and credibility. But fundamentally, it's God who is the author of life. And as we go out, we are becoming his voice, his hands, his feet to speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. So it is absolutely crucial for us as Catholics, as Christians, to allow our faith to shape and form the way we respond to the injustice and to the crisis of abortion.
Now, you know what it's like to be the pro-life warrior on the ground and having these debates and tough conversations. Can you tell us what is it like and what kind of hostilities did you face?
It's not easy, but then again, Jesus never said that following him would be easy, right? Blessed are you when they insult and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you. So when we step out and when we share the truth, yes, in love, we will have people who will not like that. So will we sometimes face threats? Yes. Have I had times where I was in a crosshairs of a sniper rifle because Planned Parenthood called the SWAT team to tell them I was a threat to their business? Yes. Did my wife have her life threatened? Yes. These are things that as leaders, sometimes regrettably, in this day and time with the political divisiveness we face, can happen. But even when you go beneath that, for the average person, the person watching us right now, they may say, well, I'm not going to lead something, but do I have to step out? Will I face some opposition? You might have some people who won't like what you say. They may call you nasty names. They may make your life miserable for a moment or for a time. But if we allow fear, fear based on the rising division and political violence and the attack against Charlie Kirk. If we allow that to silence us, then those, including the gunman who shot Charlie Kirk, and those who try to use violence to silence the truth and good will have succeeded. We can't allow that to happen. We must share the truth in love. Will there be challenges? Yes. Will we occasionally face obstacles? Yes. But if we persevere, we can trust that our Lord will be with us and guide us in doing that which will glorify and honor him and protect lives.
Amen. What do you think pro-life activists need to do to stay safe in the wake of Charlie Kirk's murder?
Mm-hmm. First of all, just be cautious, be aware. This, if anything, it drives us further to our knees to understand that we are asking God to be the one that changes hearts and minds and to use us as his instruments. So pray as you are involved, whether it's in your local pregnancy center, whether it's in a Right to Life group, or if you go out to a 40 Days for Life campaign, or you're a sidewalk advocate, whatever it is, pray and ask God to guide you and give you wisdom and discernment. Secondly, be cautious. There are people who will dislike your message, and just be on guard. Work with law enforcement when necessary. Just be willing to be aware of your surroundings. And the last thing I would say is just make sure in this heightened time of vitriol and anger to make sure that when we point out the problem of abortion and threats against human life, we also always use our voices to point people towards the loving, compassionate, and peaceful solutions so that they can be an agent of positive change rather than adding to the division and the anger that has so proliferated our culture.
A memorial service will be held for Charlie Kirk on Saturday, September 21st in Glendale, Arizona at State Farm Stadium. President Trump, Vice President J.D. Vance, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and other U.S. leaders are expected to attend. A federal appeals court in Boston is allowing the provision in the Big Beautiful Bill that defunds Planned Parenthood to proceed. This comes after several lawsuits aiming to block the provision, including a Massachusetts judge that put a preliminary injunction on the provision, halting it temporarily. While federal law already prohibits federal Medicaid funds from directly paying for abortions, the provision in the Tax Reform Act bans the use of Medicaid payments to any organization that provides abortions. Opponents argue that those Medicaid funds are used for testing for sexually transmitted diseases, HPV vaccinations, and cancer screenings. The ban will last 1 year. A new report indicates the Planned Parenthood affiliates in pro-life states rake in close to $500 million every year. And some of those funds are your tax dollars. That's according to the nonprofit American Life League. The August report also found that the financial performance of Planned Parenthood affiliates in pro-life states is nearly identical to those in abortion-supporting states. Let's break down the numbers for you. Looking broadly, there are 11 Planned Parenthood affiliates in pro-life states representing 81 facilities. Annually, those affiliates make more than $450 million, or nearly $500 million. In pro-abortion states, Planned Parenthood has 41 affiliates that represent 418 facilities. Annually, the abortion giant in those states makes some $1.8 billion in revenue. The difference is in how many affiliates are in each state. When you narrow down to what each affiliate makes, it's about the same. In pro-life states, affiliates average around $41.2 million. In pro-abortion states, the average affiliate revenue is around $43.4 million, nearly identical revenue. Katie Xavius, the national director of the American Life League, which put this report together, recently stopped by our studio to dive further into these numbers. Take a look. Katie, thank you so much for joining us here today. Now, these are really big numbers that you were sharing with us, nearly $500 million in revenue for affiliates in pro-life states and $1.8 billion in revenue for Planned Parenthoods in pro-abortion states.
Yeah.
Where is all of this money coming from?
Yeah, so this is something we wanted to look at kind of with the news that they were going to be defunded at the federal level. We hear so much about how they operate at the federal, but we wanted to look at states, too, just to kind of see where that money was coming from. And so, unfortunately, what we found is they're still being funded at the—so they were still receiving federal funding even at the state level. So this revenue comes from a mixture of tax dollars, often in the form of grant funding— and then also the money they take in from private donations, bequests, and then their services.
How do you account for the 11 affiliates in pro-life states and 41 in pro-abortion states taking in nearly the same revenue each year?
So it's really, it's something where we really wanted to look at it because it's a little bit of a head scratcher, because we hear so much news about the progress that is being made in pro-life states and a lot of states even claiming to be abortion free. But yet we're looking and we're still seeing that there's massive amounts of Planned Parenthoods, even in these pro-life states. So Texas, for example, which is, you know, we all look at Texas as a model of what a pro-life state should look like, unfortunately still has almost 30 Planned Parenthood facilities within their state, still taking in millions of dollars in revenue. So I think for pro-lifers, we really need to remember that just because a state might have, you know, some pro-life laws on the books, it doesn't mean that Planned Parenthood isn't still operating in that state. And unfortunately, they really prey on these states that have, you know, laws with exceptions or states where the abortion pill is so readily accessible. And that's really how they're able to still keep that business going in these pro-life states. Often in pro-life states especially, they're receiving Medicaid reimbursements for abortions that fall under the exception categories. So, you know, those are the rape, incest, health of the mother exceptions. And Planned Parenthood is very smart and they're good at what they do. And they're able to classify a lot of those abortions that maybe wouldn't fall under, ordinarily fall under an exception. They're able to classify it as an exception so that they can still take in those Medicaid reimbursements, which is also our tax dollars. So they're really good at kind of sneaking around the lines and finding a way to get their funding still.
And how is the federal appeals court decision to allow the Trump administration to block Medicaid funds mm-hmm. going to impact Planned Parenthood?
We're really hopeful that this is a turning point. I think the unfortunate thing is that it's only for a year. So I think given, you know, that it's going to do a lot of good for a year, we'll have to revisit this time next year, I guess, and kind of see where we're at. But we're already seeing kind of a domino effect of Planned Parenthood facilities closing, which is really great. So I think we're going to see a lot of good come out of it. But Planned Parenthood has also made really a big effort to move online as well. So I think we have to kind of move, but move smartly. And it's great that they're closing facilities, but we have to remember that they're always going to have a plan B. And right now it looks like turning their business online is their plan B. So we'll have to keep an eye on that too.
And you mentioned earlier that Texas is a big state where mm-hmm. you saw that abortions were still continuing. Can you just dig deeper into the numbers of what you found in Texas?
Sure. So in Texas, there's 29 Planned Parenthood facilities. And we know Texas is definitely one of the states that attacks Planned Parenthood more, but because of the exceptions and because of the other services that they do, which would be distribution of the abortion pill or maybe distribution of contraception or even cross-sex hormones, they still are able to have these branches in Texas. So, you know, a lot of people think pro-life is just abortion, but it goes so much beyond that, as we all know. So, and Planned Parenthood really is good at sneaking through those cracks, too.
Well, Katie, thank you so much for the work that you're doing
and
for unpacking these numbers for us.
Of course. Abby, thanks so much for having me on.
The fact that our military treatment facilities are only allowed to provide abortions in extremely limited circumstances is unacceptable.
I actually think that this is child abuse, to put these children through some type of transgender surgery.
Abortion, transgender surgeries, and other life issues have lawmakers on Capitol Hill sparring. Both chambers are debating next year's National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA. The nearly $1 trillion measure funds defense policy and priorities, but pro-life and pro-family issues are part of the act. Those issues included taxpayer-funded abortions, transgender surgeries, and nearly $1 billion for in vitro fertilization treatment for military service members and their families. The House passed its version of the NDAA. It still has to pass in the Senate. When we return, debunking the myth that pro-life laws are dangerous to mothers, we dive into the numbers of a new study on maternal morbidity and infant mortality rates in pro-life states. A recently released peer-reviewed research on infant mortality and maternal morbidity rates is challenging the narrative that pro-life laws drive up these numbers. Let's first get a look at where states stand. 12 states have strong pro-life protections. Those are highlighted in green. There are various exceptions for when the mother's life is at risk in cases of rape or fetal anomaly. 4 states, including Iowa, South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida, protect life after 6 weeks. Nebraska and North Carolina protect life after 12 weeks, Utah after 18 weeks. And Missouri's Supreme Court has reimposed the state's pro-life laws despite it being legal in the state constitution. So for now, lives are being saved there. the rest of the country has either no limits on abortion or it is limited at or near viability, which is around 23 weeks. Wyoming and Montana have bans on abortion that are currently blocked, and abortion is legal there as of now. According to a study published by BMC Public Health, there was no statistically significant difference on infant mortality rates pre- and post-Dobbs between states with and without abortion bans. The infant mortality rate remained unchanged in states with pro-life protections, and maternal morbidity actually increased significantly in pro-abortion states and remained unchanged in states with pro-life protections. Maternal morbidity means any mild to severe health problem that is short or long-term, resulting from being pregnant or giving birth. Dr. Ingrid Skop, a board-certified OBGYN and vice president and director of medical affairs at the Charlotte Lozier Institute, came by our Washington, D.C. studios to talk about this study. Can you weigh in on these findings?
Yes, and as you said, for background, since the Dobbs decision, there's been a fear-mongering narrative to try to frighten women and the public that these laws are going to harm women. And at Charlotte Lozier, we've been predicting the opposite. We think there's many reasons that these laws will protect women. And imagine the irony of saying that laws are going to cause infants to die when, in fact, these laws are going to protect their lives before birth from abortion. But as we predicted, now that the data is starting to come out, we discovered this study showed there was no increase in infant mortality. The CDC has likewise documented that there's been no increase in maternal mortality from the year 2022 to 2023. And in this study, severe maternal morbidity, which is where a woman is harmed but does not die, stayed the same in pro-life states, but it actually rose in pro-abortion states.
Wow. What do you think led to that rise?
Well, I think there's many reasons to expect pro-life laws, not just to protect that unborn child, to protect his mother as well. And doctors can provide high-quality care without performing abortions. And so that narrative needs to be debunked. But in this case, you know, every state allows an exception that permits a doctor to do whatever he needs to do to protect a mother's life in the event of a true obstetric emergency. But caring for women does not involve abortion. And these pro-abortion states, perhaps they're just not caring for women as well.
I think that would follow very likely. Now, one of the things we've been seeing, as you mentioned, is that the pro-abortion narrative has kind of taken over the mainstream media. What do you think can be done on the pro-life side to counter this narrative?
Well, it's very important to educate the public because people tend to believe what they've been told, and so much of the media is pro-abortion. And I'm sad to say that so many of the mainstream medical organizations are pro-abortion as well. So they've been driving the narrative. They've been publishing peer-reviewed papers predicting that maternal mortality was going to increase, infant mortality was going to increase. But now that we're starting to get actual data, we're finding that the opposite was the case, and that our predictions, in fact, have seemed to be more in line with reality, and that is that these laws are protecting women and are protecting their infants.
It's great to see that the truth always shines through, huh?
Yes, absolutely.
And can you tell us, what are the leading causes of death for pregnant mothers?
You know, most people think about a catastrophic event in childbirth, but that's actually only about a quarter of the maternal deaths. We recently have discovered that the number one cause of maternal deaths is mental health complications, suicides, substance overdoses. And we know that with abortion, that many women suffer mental health complications afterwards. So again, by protecting women from the violence of abortion, we will be protecting them from some of these mental health complications. Another thing that happens is that women in our country increasingly are not very healthy. And it's the women who are obese, hypertensive, diabetic, older moms, moms living in poverty. These are the women that are at much higher risk. But of course, we can address those issues with education, with better prenatal care, and we don't need to offer abortion as a solution. Likewise, with infant mortality, the number one cause is complications from preterm birth. And many studies have demonstrated that surgical abortion increases the risk of prematurity in a subsequent pregnancy. So again, by protecting women from abortion, we're going to be protecting their subsequent children from the elevated risk of preterm birth.
That's incredible. Now, you mentioned education as a possible countermeasure to, I was thinking specifically like obesity, because we know that's a problem here in our nation. How long do you think educational programs would take to begin to take effect in our culture?
Well, we need to start. So again, instead of promoting these false narratives that are designed to turn people against pro-life laws, we need to talk about what the real causes of maternal mortality are. And so, you know, obviously we do need to be talking. The MAHA movement, I think, is addressing this. Let's get Americans across the board healthier, but specifically women that want to become pregnant. Let's make sure they're very healthy before they obtain a pregnancy. And also, we need to be talking to women about the fact that you can't wait until you're 45 and then use IVF and expect to have as good an outcome as if you'd had your baby at age 25. So, you know, we really need to change our expectations, I think, about what motherhood and pregnancy should look like. But we can get there.
Yeah.
We know the answers, and the answer is not widespread abortion. There's so many better ways we can care for women.
Amen. Well, Dr. Scott, thank you so much for being here with us today, and thank you for the work that you're doing.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
That does it for this edition of EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. Be sure to like and follow us on our social media channels. You can find us at EWTN Pro-Life on X, Facebook, and Instagram. Remember, life is a gift. Your life is a gift. God bless.